From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Episode 3. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. Today, in true Storytime fashion, we will begin with some playful poems by Shel Silverstein. Silverstein was an award-winning poet, singer-songwriter, cartoonist, screenwriter, author of children's books, and most important to us, a Chicago native. He grew up in Logan Square and graduated from the University of Illinois. Our central story today is The Cask of Amontillado. Written by Edgar Allan Poe, it was first published in November 1846 in Godey's Lady's Book, which at the time was the most popular periodical in America. Cask was only published one other time during Poe's life, but has since been published often. It's been adapted to film and a variety of other formats, and is considered to be one of the world's most perfect short stories. Let's see if we agree. And then in honor of baseball season, we're gonna finish up with the single most famous baseball poem ever, Casey at the Bat by Ernest Thayer. Thayer graduated from Harvard in 1885, was good friends with William Randolph Hearst, who then hired him as the humor columnist at the San Francisco Examiner. Written in 1888, Casey was the last piece Thayer wrote for the paper. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
The Me Who with an Exactly What by Shel Silverstein. Knock, knock. Who's there? Me.
Me who?
That's right.
What's right?
Me who?
That's what I want to know.
What's what you want to know?
Me who?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly what?
Yes, I have an exactly what on a chain.
Exactly what on a chain?
Yes.
Yes, what?
No, exactly what?
That's what I want to know.
I told you. Exactly what?
Exactly what?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes. It's with me.
What's with you?
Exactly what? That's what's with me.
Me who?
Yes.
Go away.
Knock, knock.
Here Comes by Shel Silverstein. Here comes summer. Here comes summer. Chirping robin, budding rose. Here comes summer. Here comes summer. Gentle showers, summer clothes. Here comes summer. Here comes summer. Whoosh, shiver, there it goes.
The Sitter by Shel Silverstein.
Mrs. McTwitter, the babysitter, I think she's a little bit crazy. She thinks a babysitter's supposed to sit upon the baby.
Tired by Shel Silverstein. I've been working so hard, you just wouldn't believe. And I'm tired. There's so little time and so much to achieve. And I'm tired.
I've been lying here, holding the grass in its place, pressing a leaf with the side of my face, tasting the apples to see if they're sweet, counting the toes on a centipede's feet. I've been memorizing the shape of that cloud, warning the robins to not chirp so loud, shooing the butterflies off the tomatoes, keeping an eye out for floods and tornadoes. I've been supervising the work of the ants and thinking of pruning the cantaloupe plants, timing the sun to see what time it sets, calling the fish to swim into my nets, and I've taken 12,041 breaths, and I'm tired.
Overdues by Shel Silverstein.
What do I do? What do I do? This library book is 42 years overdue. I admit that it's mine, but I can't pay the fine. Should I turn it in or hide it again? What do I do? What do I do?
The Cask of Amontillado by Edgar Allan Poe. The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. You, who so well know the nature of my soul, will not suppose, however, that gave utterance to a threat. At length I would be avenged. This was a point definitely settled, but the very definitiveness with which it was resolved precluded the idea of risk. I must not only punish, but punish with impunity. A wrong is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. It is equally unredressed when the avenger fails to make himself felt as such to him who has done the wrong. It must be understood that neither by word nor deed had I given Fortunato cause to doubt my goodwill. I continued, as was my wont, to smile in his face, and he did not perceive that my smile now was at the thought of his immolation. He had a weak point, this Fortunato, although in other regards he was a man to be respected and even feared. He prided himself on his connoisseurship in wine. Few Italians have the true virtuoso spirit. For the most part, their enthusiasm is adopted to suit the time and opportunity, to practice imposture upon the British and Austrian millionaires. In painting and gemmery, Fortunato, like his countrymen, was a quack. But in the matter of old wines, he was sincere. In this respect, I did not differ from him materially. I was skillful in the Italian vintages myself, and bought largely whenever I could. It was about dusk one evening during the supreme madness of the carnival season that I encountered my friend. He accosted me with excessive warmth, for he had been drinking much. The man wore motley. He had on a tight-fitting party-striped dress, and his head was surmounted by the conical cap and bells. I was so pleased to see him that I thought I should never have done wringing his hand. I said to him, "My dear Fortunato, you are luckily met. How remarkably well you are looking today. But I have received a pipe of what passes for Amontillado, and I have my doubts."
"How?" said he. "Amontillado? A pipe? Impossible. And in the middle of the carnival?"
"I have my doubts," I replied, "and I was silly enough to pay the full Amontillado price without consulting you in the matter. You were not to be found, and I was fearful of losing a bargain."
"Amontillado!"
"I have my doubts."
"Amontillado!"
"And I must satisfy them."
"Amontillado!"
"As you are engaged, I am on my way to Lucrecy. If anyone has a critical turn, it is he. He will tell me."
"Lucrecy cannot tell Amontillado from sherry."
"And yet some fools will have it that his taste is a match for your own."
"Come, let us go."
"Whither?"
"To your vaults."
"My friend, no, I will not impose upon your good nature. I perceive you have an engagement. Lucrecy—"
"I have no engagement. Come."
"My friend, no, it is not the engagement, but the severe cold with which I perceive you are afflicted. The vaults are insufferably damp. They are encrusted with nitre."
"Let us go, nevertheless. The cold is merely nothing. Amontillado, you have been imposed upon. And as for Lucrecy, he cannot distinguish sherry from Amontillado."
Thus speaking, Fortunato possessed himself of my arm, and putting on a mask of black silk and drawing a roquelaire closely about my person, I suffered him to hurry me to my palazzo.
There were no attendants at home. They had absconded to make merry in honor of the time. I had told them that I should not return until the morning, and had given them explicit orders not to stir from the house. These orders were sufficient, I well knew, to ensure their immediate disappearance, one and all, as soon as my back was turned. I took from the sconces two flambeaux, and giving one to Fortunato, bowed him through several suites of rooms to the archway that led into the vaults. I passed down a long and winding staircase, requesting him to be cautious as he followed. We came at length to the foot of the descent, and stood together upon the damp ground of the catacombs of the Montresors. The gait of my friend was unsteady, and the bells upon his cap jingled as he strode.
"The pipe," he said.
"It is further on," said I, "but observe the white webwork which gleams from these cavern walls." He turned towards me and looked into my eyes with two filmy orbs that distilled the rheum of intoxication.
"Nitre?" he asked at length.
"Nitre," I replied. "How long have you had that cough?" My poor friend found it impossible to reply for many minutes.
"It's nothing," he said at last.
"Come," I said with decision. "We will go back. Your health is precious. You are rich, respected, admired, beloved. You are happy, as I once was. You are a man to be missed. For me, it is no matter. We will go back. You will be ill, and I cannot be responsible. Besides, there is Lucrece."
"Enough," he said. "The cough's a mere nothing. It will not kill me. I shall not die of a cough."
"True, true," I replied. "And indeed, I have no intention of alarming you unnecessarily. But you should use all proper caution. A draught of this Medoc will defend us from the damps." Here I knocked off the neck of a bottle which I drew from a long row of its fellows that lay upon the mold. "Drink," I said, presenting him the wine. He raised it to his lips with a leer. He paused and nodded to me familiarly while his bells jingled.
"I drink," he said, "to the buried that repose around us.
And I to your long life." He again took my arm and we proceeded.
"These vaults," he said, "are extensive."
"The Montresors," I replied, "were a great and numerous family."
"I forget your arms."
"A huge human foot door in a field azure. The foot crushes a serpent rampant whose fangs are embedded in the heel."
"And the motto?"
"Nemo me impune lacet." "No one attacks me with impunity."
"Good," he said.
The wine sparkled in his eyes and the bells jingled. My own fancy grew warm with the Medoc. We had passed through long walls of piled skeletons, with casks and puncheons intermingling, into the innermost recesses of the catacombs. I paused again, and this time I made bold to seize Fortunato by the arm above the elbow.
"The nitre," I said. "See? It increases. It hangs like moss upon the vaults. We are below the river's bed. The drops of moisture trickle among the bones.
Come, we will go back ere it is too late. Your cough..."
"It is nothing," he said, "but let us go on. But first, another draught of the Medoc."
I broke and reached him a flagon of De Grave. He emptied it at a breath. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upwards with a gesticulation I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise. He repeated the movement, a grotesque one.
"You do not comprehend," he said.
"Not I," I replied.
"Then you are not of the Brotherhood."
"How?"
"You are not of the Masons."
"Yes, yes," I said. "Yes, yes."
"You? Impossible. A Mason?"
"A Mason," I replied.
"A sign," he said. "A sign."
"It is this," I answered, producing from beneath the folds of my roquelaire a trowel.
"You jest," he exclaimed, recoiling a few paces. "But let us proceed to the Amontillado."
"Be it so," I said, replacing the tool beneath the cloak and again offering him my arm. He leaned upon it heavily. We continued our route in search of the Amontillado.
we passed through a range of low arches, descended, passed on, and descending again, arrived at a deep crypt in which the foulness of the air caused our flambeaux rather to glow than flame. At the most remote end of the crypt, there appeared another less spacious. Its walls had been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead in the fashion of the great catacombs of Paris. Three sides of this interior crypt were still ornamented in this manner. From the fourth side, the bones had been thrown down and lay promiscuously upon the earth, forming at one point a mound of some size. Within the wall thus exposed by the displacing of the bones, we perceived a still interior crypt or recess in depth about 4 feet, in width 3, in height 6 or 7. It seemed to have been constructed for no especial use within itself, but formed merely the interval between two of the colossal supports of the roof of the catacombs, and was backed by one of their circumscribing walls of solid granite. It was in vain that Fortunato, uplifting his dull torch, endeavored to pry into the depth of the recess. Its termination, the feeble light, did not enable us to see. "Proceed," I said. "Herein is the Amontillado. As for Lucrezia..."
"He is an ignoramus," interrupted my friend,
as he stepped unsteadily forward, while I followed immediately at his heels. In niche, and finding an instant he had reached the extremity of the niche, and finding his progress arrested by the rock, stood stupidly bewildered. A moment more and I had fettered him to the granite. In its surface were two iron staples, distant from each other about 2 feet horizontally. From one of these depended a short chain, from the other a padlock. Throwing the links about his waist, it was but the work of a few seconds to secure it. He was too much astounded to resist. Withdrawing the key, I stepped back from the recess. "Pass your hand," I said, "over the wall. You cannot help feeling the nitre. Indeed, it is very damp. Once more, let me implore you to return." "No? Then I must positively leave you. But I must first render you all the little attentions in my power."
"The Amontillado!" ejaculated my friend,
not yet recovered from his astonishment. "True," I replied, "the Amontillado." As I said these words, I busied myself among the pile of bones of which I have before spoken. Throwing them aside, I soon uncovered a quantity of building stone and mortar. With these materials, and with the aid of my trowel, I began vigorously to wall up the entrance of the niche. I had scarcely laid the first tier of the masonry when I discovered that the intoxication of Fortunato had in a great measure worn off. The earliest indication I had of this was a low moaning cry from the depth of the recess. It was not the cry of a drunken man. There was a long and obstinate silence. I laid the second tier, and the third, and the fourth, and then I heard the furious vibrations of the chain. The noise lasted for several minutes, during which, that I might hearken to it with the more satisfaction, I ceased my labors and sat down upon the bones. When at last the clanking subsided, I resumed the trowel, and finished without interruption the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh tier. The wall was now nearly upon a level with my breast. I again paused, and holding the flambeau over the mason work, threw a few feeble rays upon the figure within. A succession of loud and shrill screams, bursting suddenly from the throat of the chained form, seemed to thrust me violently back. For a brief moment, I hesitated. I trembled. Unsheathing my rapier, I began to grope with it about the recess. But the thought of an instant reassured me. I placed my hand upon the solid fabric of the catacombs and felt satisfied. I reapproached the wall. I replied to the yells of him who clamored. I re-echoed. I aided. I surpassed them in volume and in strength. I did this
and the clamorer grew still. It was now midnight, and my task was drawing to a close. I had completed the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the 11th. There remained but a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position, but now there came out of the niche a low laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said,
It's a very good joke, indeed. An excellent jest. We will have many a rich laugh about it at the palazzo. Over the wine.
The Amontillado, I said.
Yes, the Amontillado. But is it not getting late? Will not they be awaiting us at the palazzo? The Lady Fortunato and the rest. Let us be gone.
Yes, I said. Let us be gone.
For the love of God, Montresor.
Yes, I said. For the love of God. But to these words I hearkened in vain for a reply. I grew impatient. I called aloud. Fortunato! No answer, I called again. Fortunato! No answer still. I thrust a torch through the remaining aperture and let it fall within. There came forth in return only a jingling of the bells. My heart grew sick. It was the dampness of the catacombs that made it so. I hastened to make an end of my labor. I forced the last stone into its position. I plastered it up. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. For the half of a century, no mortal has disturbed them. In pace, requiescat. Rest in peace.
Casey at the Bat by Ernest Thayer. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 2-4, with but an inning left to play. So when Cooney died at second, and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest, with the hope which springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought, if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake, and the former was a puddin', and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude a deathlike silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all, and the much despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakey safe at second, and Flynn a huggin' third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It rumbled in the mountaintops, it rattled in the dell, it struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then, when the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip,
Defiance glanced in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered spear came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped.
"That ain't my style," said Casey.
"Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on the stern and distant shore.
"Kill him! Kill the umpire!"
shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He made the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!"
"Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!"
But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let the ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel vengeance his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Kohlwacker, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.